Hello and welcome back to another day here at The Damage Report. In a world that seems increasingly damaged every day. Now normally on Thursdays I'm here alone, but not today. It's a big news day and so we had to bring in Jared Jackson.
Yes, hey, I'm sure you guys looked up yesterday and you were like, it's Wednesday.
Where's JR?
What's going on? Everyone was thinking that. I don't think anyone focused on anything that you said yesterday.
No, they were just sad and distracted, probably. But welcome back. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
So look, we do have a big news day. Obviously, we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and the ever worsening pandemic that we're experiencing right now. A little bit later on the show, though, I want to check in with right-wing media. They have had a hard time figuring out how to communicate about this since their devotion to protecting the reputation of Trump trumps their concern for the lives of their audience. And so I have noticed a trend now in the last 24 hours. How are they communicating about coronavirus? It's turned in an oddly dark direction. So we're gonna be talking about that a little bit later on. Shahid Buttar, a candidate for Congress against Nancy Pelosi, is gonna be joining us a little bit later on. And we've just got a ton to talk about. So with that, why don't we jump into it? Yesterday, Donald Trump addressed the nation and his goal was to announce changes that we made to make our country more resistant to COVID-19. But more importantly, perhaps, to reassure the nation that he's taking this seriously and that he has the gravitas necessary to take us through a tough situation. Unfortunately, when his address ended and he thought the cameras weren't rolling anymore, he might have undercut that a little bit.
We're clear.
Okay.
Okay. You just got done talking about like emergency measures that you're putting into place to make sure that as few people as possible become infected with this novel coronavirus and perhaps die. Okay, oh boy, that was something that's effectively, and I get it. He didn't think he was on camera. Right. I understand that. I probably say some ridiculous things when I'm not on camera. No one's life is in my hands though.
Yeah, I guess that's the question is, if anyone's surprised by, I guess the first thing is, I take that back. The first thing is, what do we read this to mean? Okay.
That he's not a serious person.
That he's not serious.
I mean, he's scared, I guess, that he's, like the idea that he has to read from a teleprompter and be serious, like that must terrify him.
Right. Well, I came to that conclusion based off him golfing last weekend during the height of this. Him calling it a hoax from the beginning. Him saying that as soon as it gets to April, it's going to be over. All those things gave me the indication that he has no idea what he's doing or what he's talking about, and that he doesn't take it seriously enough to change things to make sure that things get taken care of in a different way.
Yeah.
So the okay, actually, I saw it making its rounds, and I'm willing to be proven wrong on this. I don't think it's that big a deal.
Okay.
I think it's Trump being not even necessarily being Trump. I think it's a normal moment where once the thing ends, yes, he's detached. But as I mentioned, other things have given me reason to believe that this particular instance is just okay. Done with that. It's just he says it like
a child.
He says everything. Like in my opinion,
okay,
he may be talking about trade with China, but when he says China, it makes me think this is a child, right? Yeah.
So okay. You know, I disagree, but
yeah,
fine. That was just our little comic intro or whatever. Let's jump into the substance of what he said, what effect it's had. Now, we know that in America, there is no more important metric in terms of how the country is doing than the stock market's performance. So let's check in with US stocks this morning. Oh my God. They've fallen off of some sort of cliff. I think that the Roadrunner made them think the road continued off the cliff and then they looked down and realized there was no floor below them. But
take all your money out of Acme products.
Exactly.
Right now.
So just minutes after markets opened, they were temporarily shut down after the S&P 500 index dipped below a crucial threshold, losing 7% of its value in a rapid sell-off of leading stocks. That's not the first time, by the way, that this emergency measure to stop the economy from cratering had to be instituted just this week. So it dropped. That was not the last drop. Eventually it came back and dropped some more. The Dow is on pace for the worst day since October 19th, 1987, 5 years before I was born. I'm just gonna leave it out there. Put it on Wikipedia, people. Anyway, but no, obviously this is absolutely horrendous. I made a bad decision yesterday. I looked at my 401k and it was not good. It was the money would be better served if I had just put it in my closet.
Right.
So anyway, and I'm lucky enough to have one. Imagine people who are like jobs are being wiped out right now because of all these events that are shutting down. Lots of people that rely on those sorts of events, either directly working for them or as a result of people coming into a city, that sort of thing. Lots of people are gonna be losing their jobs. I can't mention this enough, but apparently Chinese restaurants are losing tons of business.
Yeah.
Partially just because everything's bad, but also because of xenophobia.
Yep.
So I'm ordering Chinese takeout constantly because I wanna help. Economically, this is not good.
Well, okay, so this is when you know, of course, we know how America works. Once things like this happen with the stock markets and fall offs happen, then now it's a serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, before this happened, we just talked about the president going okay and not really caring, mm-hmm. among other things. But now that this is happening to the people who are rich and powerful generally, that have this kind of money, not that you're rich and powerful because you checked your 401k, but I'm talking about people who are really invested in the stock market.
Yeah.
Now it's a serious matter when stuff like this drops off. But there's people, if once we're telling people to go back to work, it doesn't matter whatever kind of spread happens. Sure, you may have symptoms, but that's not a big deal. That affects people who actually live paycheck to paycheck, and it's mm-hmm. not their worth laid up in the stock market that's doing something to them.
Yeah.
They need to take home money in order to feed themselves, continue to pay their rent.
Yeah.
With gas in their cars just to get back to work. So I wish that the severity of the situation was put there,
yeah.
when like I guess a lot less powerful people were affected.
Yeah, and look, I can't say for sure exactly what caused so much uncertainty or whatever. Man, stock market's really affected by uncertainty. I don't know for sure, but Trump's remarks obviously didn't help. The stock market dropped last night while he was speaking. And I think there's potentially a few reasons for that. A lack of seriousness, but also a lack of honesty. And I have instances of both of that. So he had one quote in that address. He said, "We're having to fix a problem that 4 weeks ago nobody ever thought would be a problem. Here's the issue. The first US case of COVID-19 was 7 weeks ago, and that followed months of international cases. The idea that he only started thinking about it a little bit 4 weeks ago, so that's weeks after we had cases, months after other people had cases, that is cause for uncertainty. And also, the things that he announced, the big changes, some of those details apparently weren't even true last night when he said them. So Trump had said that prohibitions on travel from the EU would not only apply to the tremendous amount of trade and cargo, but various other things as we get approval. This morning, the White House says, no, it's not affecting trade or goods or cargo or anything like that. So either Trump didn't know or he was lying. And even in terms of that ban, it's banning travel from most European countries, but not the UK, even though the UK has by far the most COVID-19 infections out of the EU. And look, I hate to have to question Trump, but I don't think that we can leave out the fact that Trump properties are in the UK. And so hypothetically, it would be really damaging for him if he couldn't travel there. And why am I saying that? Well, if you really wanted to stop people from coming in with COVID-19, why not ban travel from the place where it is actually? Like rather than random European countries that have been so far relatively unaffected.
Because it affects him more severely if it happens there. It's pretty straight. It's a straightforward case. He's not a very nuanced person. One more thing about we're having to fix a problem 4 weeks ago that no one ever thought would be a problem. Donald Trump says when he says nobody ever thought, he means himself.
Yeah,
that's
he didn't think
him.
About it.
That's him. That I didn't think would be a problem. That's where he goes with that. And also, we're having to fix a problem. We're gonna have to fix a problem. Who started it? Again, I guess those Democrats and the global deep state that's coming after him. It's never him. It's never on his watch. And it's also something no one ever saw coming.
Yeah. So look, I don't want to just criticize the government response to COVID-19. Let's be productive. Let's suggest what they could actually do. So one of the biggest issues, we're gonna bring this up. This is early COVID-19 testing per capita. So based on how many people you have, how many tests are you doing? Let's take a look and you're gonna see That we have a population of 329 million people, the largest of all of those countries. And we are, you can barely see the 23 tests per million people. Whereas other countries, including countries that have been relatively more successful in limiting it, are doing far more testing. And that has, from the very beginning, been the biggest issue and one that Donald Trump refuses, for the most part, to even talk about. Now, currently, catching up to today, according to the AEI, 16,030 COVID-19 tests can be processed in the US a day, up from a little bit under 8,000 a few days ago. South Korea has been running more than 10,000 per day since February, even though they are a far, far, far larger, smaller country. And the issue is that maximum capacity does not mean that that's how many tests are actually being done. You've probably seen accounts from all over the country of individuals saying that they have reason to believe that they have COVID-19, but because their symptoms aren't so bad that they would need to be hospitalized for it, they can't get tested right now. And people have been asking for weeks, when are you gonna make more tests available? What is taking so long? And Trump does not wanna talk about that. And what, in terms of the Republican ability to put pressure on Trump, the Democrats last night rolled out their bill to try to help this situation, take some of the economic pressure off of everyone. And no, they're not taking up that bill. They said it falls short, even though they don't have anything. And in fact, a McConnell ally says the Senate won't take up a House bill until after a recess. Senator Lamar Alexander said the Senate will act when we come back, and we have a clear idea of what extra steps we need to take. So that's in maybe 12 days. And I got news for you. In Italy, the number of infections in a 12-day span went up by more than 10 times. We could have 10,000, 15, 20,000 cases by the time they finally get back to town and decide to take this up. Because I don't know if Lamar Alexander knows this, but COVID-19 is not going on recess just because you want a break to go home and fundraise.
Luckily, by the time we get to those 15, 20,000 cases, it'll be April. And then by April, it's getting warmer, right? Of course,
because that's what we've heard.
You know, it's 85 degrees in April across the United States. Mm-hmm. So once it gets warmer in April, it's all going to be taken care of anyway. Again, I'm referring back to it only because we forget the things that he has said and done just a couple weeks ago that have contributed to this or have ignored the problem. It's maddening, and if you bring it up, you're a hater, you're deranged, the Trump derangement syndrome. But what's happening with the actual numbers going on in our country? Yeah. You can't deny it.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. Lots more important stuff to get to after this. The sorry state of our democracy, access to voting rights in a meaningful way. That's something that some presidential candidates have talked quite a bit about, but not all of them. What would Joe Biden do in this area were he to become the nominee and eventually perhaps the president? Joining us now to break this down, Adam Eichen, author and campaigns manager for Equal Citizens. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you on. So this is a topic that we have talked about quite a few times. And now we have a guy who's looking like there's a good chance he might be the nominee. And so I'm trying to get caught up a bit on his record, what he might represent in this area. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, John, as you and I have talked about on the show before, is that this 2020 election cycle, for at least for the Democrats, has been historic in terms of the number of candidates presenting remarkably bold plans to fix our democracy. The most critical dilemma facing Democrats is how to unrig the system to actually allow for majority rule once again. And the Democrats have largely risen to that challenge, releasing plans tackling money in politics, gerrymandering, voting rights, with a lot of specific details about reforms that have been proven to work in states across the country. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I was really optimistic about the way this primary was shaping up. Of course, the one exception to that was Joe Biden. Joe Biden has released a rather strong money in politics campaign finance plan. But on the topics of voting rights and gerrymandering, he's been remarkably silent, which is a major red flag as far as I'm concerned. He has, you know, he said that voting rights would be a foundation of his administration, but really the only specifics that he's given are restoring the Voting Rights Act, which is critical, but it's not enough. In one of the debates, I believe in New Hampshire, he said automatic voter registration, but he didn't really seem to know what that meant. So this is a real red flag as far as I'm concerned.
Look, and I think it's so emblematic of his approach to everything. It's, I can identify a thing that was taken away in the last 10 years. I'll give you that back. And that perhaps might be the limitation there. Now, in his plan, you talked about public financing of elections, empowering the DOJ to enforce current laws. That, I'm assuming, is not enough to get America to where it needs to be.
No, of course not. And you and I have talked about this before, that we need, you know, really bold reforms when it comes to voting rights. I mean, you look at states across the country, Georgia, Ohio, you know, Wisconsin, voter suppression is getting worse and worse and worse. And we need federal guidelines. We need Congress to step up in a way that, you know, earlier, or I guess last year, the Democrats, the very first act they did was H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which was a remarkably bold piece of legislation that tackles all of these different areas of democracy, you know, mandates things like automatic voter registration, same day voter registration, and the list goes on, restoration of voting rights for formerly incarcerated felons. And we just don't know where Biden stands on this. I mean, even on H.R. 1, he tweeted, you know, in kind of celebration of the 1 year anniversary of H.R. 1's passage in the House. But if you read the tweet closely, he didn't actually commit to passing H.R. 1. So this is a major question mark. Would he support H.R. 1? And perhaps even more importantly, would he prioritize it if elected? Because the Democrats, most Democrats know by now that this has to be prioritized, that this has to be a day one priority in 2021 if they take back the Senate and the House. And we just don't have that commitment from Joe Biden at the moment.
You know, I want to get into some potential changes that could be made hypothetically. And there's one that you've written an article about recently, endorsing a bill in Massachusetts that would hypothetically lower the voting age down to 16. Tell me about that plan and why you're endorsing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the reforms that goes beyond the kind of the most immediate reforms, you know, like AVR, same day registration, restoration of voting rights to those incarcerated. You know, but lowering the voting age has always been really interesting to me because 18, if you really think about it, is a terrible year to be integrated into the political process. You know, a lot of folks are going to college, maybe they're becoming independent for the first time, they're getting their first job. There's a lot of changes when you're 18. And so lowering the voting age to 17 or 16 could be a really strong way to increase youth participation, because voting is habitual. We know that the first time you vote, it makes it more likely that you vote a second time, a third time. And so if we can get people into the political process a little bit earlier while they're still under the auspices of their parents, while they're still kind of integrated into a community before they're independent, I think there's a lot of promise here. And we see this with, you know, in the primary so far, youth turnout has been good, but it's still not where it should be. Yeah. And so this is one of the things that as we're looking forward to H.R. 1 and beyond, I've just become convinced that if we can just lower it to 17, 16, it could have some real transformative impacts on the electorate.
Yeah, and look, I think you perfectly lay out the sort of pragmatic case and the case for increased participation from doing this. But also, in your article, you have a reference to what I would say is sort of the moral case for this, which is the consequences of our decisions on a host of matters from climate change to economic policy will affect them the longest. Don't we want their voice in our democracy? Which I think it makes so much sense because we're dealing with issues like what's going to happen with the climate crisis. And almost universally, the people who are deciding are people who are not going to see the results of this plan.
Right, exactly. And you see, you know, the Sunrise Movement, the remarkable activism by these people who are not even 18 yet. They're leading the dialogue on the existential question of our times about the very health and you know, of our planet. And they're the ones driving that discussion. And so people will always counter to me and say, oh, well, young people, have you ever met a 16-year-old? Yes, I've worked alongside them in the trenches of democracy reform, in the trenches of environmental, you know, preventing climate change. I've been nothing but impressed with the amazing talent that young people have. And we should be welcoming them into the political process, not trying to say, oh, they're too stupid to participate, because that's just not the experience most people have with younger individuals.
Yeah, and if someone is watching this and hasn't paid much attention to some of these activists, I want to reassure them that it's not just that they will be affected by these issues more or that they have more passion for these issues. If you listen to Greta speak, if you talk with Varshini Prakash, they understand these issues. They understand the science of these issues, the likely consequences of action and inaction far better than I've heard the vast majority of senators or elected representatives of any form. So they also have the knowledge, and I think thus the knowledge to vote in an informed way about these things.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the bill in Massachusetts would allow localities to lower the voting age for local elections. You know, this is going to be a long-term fight. This is not something that's going to happen in 2021. But I'm really interested to see localities and states push the ball forward on this topic, because I do think that, you know, this could be a real moment of transformation. You know, yeah. the voting age was lowered to 18 during the Vietnam War. And there was a real crisis then. And now, my colleague Josh Douglas and I, as we wrote in the article that you're talking about, as we say, today there's a new crisis, and that's climate change. And so whether or not we move to expand the electorate in the age of this crisis remains to be seen. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I think it would be a valuable step for our democracy.
Adam, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody watching, please go take a look at that article available in Commonwealth Magazine. Adam, we really appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, a little bit more on COVID-19 after this. Close to 2 months now, the default communication strategy on COVID-19 for much of right-wing media is this is a hoax, it's another impeachment attempt against the president, it's all made up, you got nothing to worry about. Now you would imagine that what comes after that is, okay, maybe this is a real situation that we should take seriously, but it turns out most of them have skipped that and landed on a new stage, which I'm calling, why are you so afraid to die anyways? And so we got a few examples of that. First, here's Sean Hannity.
Because
can I be philosophical a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. We're all dying, and I'm not trying to be Irish here, but that's kind of an Irish thing if you think about it.
Yeah.
And number two, we don't own anything. We all think we own our homes, we own our cars, we own our expensive watches. I hate watches. I don't even have one. We own this, we own that. Guess what, Bill? When you die, someone else is living in your house, driving your car, and wearing your watch unless you're stupid enough to take it into the grave with you.
Okay, so if you're worried about COVID-19 spreading across the country, we're all dying anyways. Imagine big terrorist attack in America. And the next day I say to people, look, yeah, it's scary, but like, we're all gonna die someday anyway.
Absolutely, it's such a perfect example. The way the energy and attention we put on, of course, 9/11, which I think for good reason. Imagine anyone like, again, how long ago was that? You know, 19 years.
Ago.
So if you make a joke about 9/11, which many people have, it's like off limits, which I'm okay with that too.
Yeah, I think it's too soon.
But if you can say, hey, people are dying of this spreading pandemic that now has been rightfully called that. Hey, you're just dying anyway, it's okay. Why is that not the same thing? If not worse, at least when someone's joking, they expect maybe some humor behind it, and we're just joking, and I don't mean to offend. But here, you mean to offend, and you're being serious. This is worse.
We're all dying anyway.
Because you know what? If something happened to these guys or their family members, they'd have a problem with death suddenly.
I imagine so. Let's go now to another example. So that was Sean Hannity, who, by the way, goes on to say, we're doing everything we can anyway, sure, you know, except for making testing kits available so that people know if they have the disease. That seems like a pretty important step. I would do that. But now we have Rush Limbaugh, who one like Dr. Fauci, one of these the big government doctors who's been talking about this, talked about how deadly it is in comparison to seasonal flu. And Rush Limbaugh is angry at him and the news for pointing out that it can kill you.
On the Drudge page right now is this. Top doc, virus 10 times more lethal than the flu. Now, wait, that's not that they're burying the lead. That headline is going to scare people to death. That's not the point of the story. Do you know what's really the point of the story? The fatality rate is just 1% from this disease. So who cares if it's 10 times more lethal than the flu? The fatality rate of coronavirus is 1%. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told lawmakers a hearing on Wednesday that COVID-19 is probably about 10 times more lethal than the seasonal flu. 10 times more lethal? Lethal than what? What does lethal mean? Does lethal kill you? Does lethal infect you? Does lethal give you a temperature of 102 versus 105? What does it do to you? It's a meaningless comparative.
It's not meaningless. First of all, I don't agree with him that in the end the overall fatality rate is one, but let's say it is. It's not meaningless to point out that it's 10 times more deadly. The meaning is that it's 10 times more deadly. And when he says, what does lethal mean? Well, it means it'll kill you. Does lethal kill you? Yes, that's what it means. And no, lethal doesn't infect you. It describes the fact that this disease, if you get it, you are, all else being equal, 10 times more likely to die, which seems like an important thing for people to know if you want them to take the precautions that will be necessary to stop them from infecting themselves and perhaps others as well.
He doesn't care about that. He knows what lethal means, but he also is banking on the fact that his audience does not know what lethal means, and he can say all this, and then they'll continue to go, yeah, what does lethal mean, really, Rush? You're right, bro. And then he can push the narrative to make sure that his president doesn't look too bad. That is goal number one, to make sure he and I don't look too bad based off the fact that we didn't take this seriously. Yeah. It's as simple as you didn't take it seriously. And if you took it seriously, the rest of the public wouldn't have to take it seriously the way they have to now, that you're now criticizing them for.
Yeah, and look, I've been criticizing them for weeks now, saying that they are misinforming their audience and making it more likely that their audience will become infected with coronavirus and die. And there's some evidence of that already. According to a Reuters Ipsos poll conducted on March 2nd to 3rd, 21% of Democrats, compared to just 14% of Republicans, said they were taking steps to avoid physical contact with others. That's a 50% gap right there between the two. 48% of Democratic respondents said they were washing their hands more often to prevent transmission of the virus, compared to 38% of Republicans. So look, unless you believe that Republicans are just naturally more nasty, this is the result of them being told it's a hoax, it's not serious, you don't have to worry about it. He is, to this day, that was the 10th, no, sorry, Rush Limbaugh, that was the 11th. That was yesterday that he said that. We had already passed 1,200 cases in the US. We'd already passed a couple dozen deaths. And he is still actively encouraging his fans to die from this rather than take it seriously.
Remember Pete Hegseth, like last year, said that I don't wash my hands? And then later he said, you guys, I was joking. I can't believe you'd actually go for that. We were all laughing on set. You mean laughing at you. But fine, you know, let's go with the fact that you're joking really fast. After that, he was clowning people for taking his joke seriously. He then also said, hey, actually, I was making a critical point about people who walk around with bottles of Purell in their pockets. They sanitize 19,000 times a day as if that's going to save their life. I take care of myself and all that, but I don't obsess over everything all the time. This might be the time to start. This was 1 year ago. This is February, I believe, of 19.
Yeah.
When he said, I was joking about the hand washing thing. But then again, when you criticize people for keeping their hands clean, are you joking?
Maybe you're training them to not keep their hands clean. Okay, one more example. Perhaps the most direct example of what I've been talking about here is Michael Knowles.
Why are people so afraid of death? I have to imagine it has something to do with the precipitous decline in religiosity. An important takeaway from coronavirus: you are going to die. Probably better when you think of that, instead of just running out to the store and buying up all the toilet paper and canned tomatoes that you possibly can. It's probably a better use of your time to think ahead to that certainty that will come.
Okay, so to be clear, he's not saying that coronavirus is necessarily going to kill you, but he is saying don't worry about it because we're all going to die eventually. And then that last bit was him saying, rather than take precautions, and I understand some of the examples he's giving are people taking precautions in kind of a weird overreaction way. You don't need 3 years of toilet paper, but washing your hands, avoiding big public gatherings, these are not crazy things. He says, rather than those precautions, sit and meditate on the Zen koan of how your life is someday going to end anyway.
I have an idea.
So lay down and accept your death. That's what the right-wing media is telling their fans. Remember, really fast, it's not libs who are watching these shows. They're not watching Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Knowles. We're not being deceived by them. It is trusting naive conservatives, the people who trust them above all others, that they're saying, stop fearing your own death. Don't do anything to stop this. Certainly don't put pressure on our dear leader. Just lay down and accept your death.
Think about all the things that conservatives are afraid of as far as death. Why are we overrun with guns in the country? Outside of the fact that they just think it's fun. Because you have to protect yourself in your house. Because someone might come in and kill you. Why are we so concerned about, particularly we talk about 9/11, terrorists, they're gonna come kill you. Hey, why, we do nothing about terrorists. Oh, abortion rights. Oh, you're anti-choice because, you know, that child deserves a shot at life. He's gonna die anyway. Who cares if it's at 2 minutes old or if it's at 95 years old? You must not care about kids, right? And lastly, you know, Republicans, they're afraid of black people. Sorry, I'm messing. But in reality, they're worried about all these things, and it's their platform to say life, 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 life. Suddenly, life doesn't matter anymore.
No.
Why is that?
Because you worrying about your safety might lead you to wonder why the government isn't doing more to safeguard it. And Donald Trump is the representative of that. And so if you're frustrated by the lack of action by the government, you might start to wonder why Donald Trump is a total buffoon, not taking this seriously. And they don't want that. And they are willing to increase the odds that you don't make it through this crisis if that protects Donald Trump's approval rating in an election year. It's sad, but it's true. These are not old videos. That's what they're saying now. And by the way, that Michael Knowles, Ted Cruz just went on a show like a day or two ago. These people are taken very seriously by the right.
No, no lie. They're all actors. As soon as they get off camera, they're going to be like, let me go ahead and make sure I take these precautions and make sure I don't get this.
Exactly. Okay, we're going to take a short break, but an awesome candidate is going to join us after this. I'm going to keep it real with you. These last few election days have had some disappointing outcomes in a number of different races. But that does not mean that there are not bright spots to give us some hope. And one of those was in California's 12th district, where Nancy Pelosi, the literal Speaker of the House, her fiercest challenger, Shahid Buttar, has moved past the first obstacle and will now be going up against her in the general election. And he joins us now on the Damage Report. Shahid, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, John. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, great to be talking with you. So first of all, congratulations. I imagine you're feeling pretty elated at the result.
Absolutely. It's a historic victory to have an intra-party challenge to Pelosi in the general election, and she hasn't faced a Democrat in November in 30 years. And I'm eager to end her career and get a voice in that seat who will stand with our communities and the future.
So talk to me about the strategy. I mean, you've been running for some time. Do things change in some fundamental way now that it's down to just the two?
Yes, absolutely. To this point, I ran for the seat in 2018 and obviously in the primary cycle for the 2020 election. And to get into the general, the order of business was very much consolidating the progressive vote in San Francisco, and that's where we focused. At this point, having now fought my way into the general, the strategy very much shifts. The message stays the same, platform stays the same. The doors we're knocking on, however, change. And instead of knocking on the doors of the progressive stalwarts in our city strongholds, we're now spreading out to particularly engage the moderate votes in the city. And that's how, over the next 8 months, we're going to secure the votes that we need to liberate this seat.
So let me ask you about those moderates. When you're talking to some of these people, what is their impression of Nancy Pelosi? Do they have the sort of, like, I guess, nuanced understanding, or are a lot of these people sort of like, yeah, she's been around forever, she's the leader, yes, queen. Like, what do they actually think about her? How much do they know about her record?
Entirely too little, frankly. I mean, that is the challenge before our campaign, is precisely to educate the electorate about how our city's elected representative has shown up in Washington. And the whole reason I'm running for this seat is that over the last 20 years, as I've taken action to challenge Bush's wars and Obama's deportations and drone strikes and Trump's corruption, I have consistently seen Nancy Pelosi standing on the side of conservatives instead of San Francisco. I was fighting in the courts for marriage equality on behalf of my gay neighbors 10 years before Nancy Pelosi even acknowledged their rights. And that kind of distinction, I think, is the kind that we need to spread across the district to make sure that everybody realizes. You know, one of the things in particular that's been challenging is the construction of Nancy Pelosi as a lion of the supposedly liberal left. And the photo ops for which she's become infamous, ripping up a speech, pointing across a table, shadily clapping, putting on her sunglasses as she leaves the meeting sternly. These are the images that have contrived, frankly, an impression of her in the district that doesn't at all match the reality. And she is a powerful member of Congress, but she hasn't shown up for our communities. You know, there is a virus outbreak right now, a pandemic, and we don't have Medicare for all. And it's great that Nancy Pelosi is now going to Congress trying to get the resources for free test kits at this point. They should have been in place months ago, yep. and it shouldn't be limited to this particular public health crisis. That's the kind of distinction that our campaign offers the city. It's one of the reasons why I'm so confident that I'll be representing San Francisco in Congress next year.
Shahid, whenever it comes to running against a Democrat that is generally disliked to this degree by Republicans, you know, you got Hillary Clinton's, the Chuck Schumer's, and in this case, Nancy Pelosi's. How do you make sure that your message doesn't get co-opted by hateful people on the right to try and make it sound like you're speaking the same way as them? I mean, I've seen it when Bernie was running against Hillary, and then also in this case, Donald Trump is pushing this narrative as if he's supportive of Bernie Sanders just to get people to think that he's like him. How are you avoiding that narrative?
Well, at the end of the day, here in San Francisco, we don't have a lot of right-wing trolls, frankly, and Trump, thankfully, has very little support in this city. The platform that I'm running on is so unabashedly democratically socialist. I'm running on a Green New Deal, Medicare for all. I'm running to end mass surveillance and end mass incarceration. And that's a platform that I don't think anybody could seriously think aligns with that of the right wing. Mm-hmm. I will say that there are opportunities when we, after I replace Pelosi, to transcend the partisan divide, particularly on issues related to ending mass incarceration. That's an issue of transpartisan consensus, and there's libertarian support for reducing not only the number of people who we incarcerate, but also the size of our police forces, to demilitarize police, to end mass surveillance, to restore human rights that our country has unfortunately abandoned in the last 20 years. Those are transpartisan issues where I do find alignment with allies in the Republican Party who are also challenging their party center to vindicate constitutional principles. And that's an area where I invite, frankly, conflation. But as to the, you know, the demagoguery of Trumpies who try to, you know, reinforce the same narrative that Speaker Pelosi promotes, that there are only two sides in politics and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Obviously, we see today there are lots of sides in politics. There are outright fascists, for instance, the one in the White House, and there are corporate Democrats who enable them, like Nancy Pelosi. I, Bernie Sanders, the movement that surrounds him and that is that he has helped unleash and that will continue long beyond this election cycle, we are running to defend the future. That's what Bernie's done for 50 years. It's what I've done for 20. It's what we're all very eager to do when we finally win these seats and are able to take this voice to Washington.
You know, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. I know that you've been endorsed by a number of different organizations, the Bay Area for Bernie, San Francisco Berniecrats, Our Revolution factions. You know, I got to keep it real. The last couple of weeks haven't necessarily been great for Bernie Sanders. I'm curious, as someone who is also engaged in this fight, how have you reacted to what's been going on lately?
On the one hand, it has been disappointing, particularly to see older African American voters support a nominee, Joe Biden, who has done so much to eviscerate African American communities. You know, Joe Biden is responsible for the mass incarceration crisis to a large extent, at least as much as anyone else in Congress. He's responsible for indenturing young people to decades of student debt that they're unable to relieve through the same bankruptcy protections available to other people who have debts. And in spite of that record, Joe Biden has gained support from people who think that he's electable. And I just want to be clear here, there's nothing electable about someone who can't tell the difference between their wife and their sister. And I'm not saying that to be an asshole. I'm saying that because Joe Biden, unfortunately, is not the man that he once was. And it's ironic. I think if the centrists were to settle on anyone, he is the last person who makes sense for them to settle on. But of course, he was the last one standing after the South Carolina results. At this point in the race, in years past, lots of candidates had done well on Super Tuesday who did not go on to secure the nomination. Mm-hmm. This race isn't done yet by a mile. There are plenty of delegates left. Bernie still has the most support of any single candidate in the race. When we look at Biden's support, it's not support for him. What it is ultimately is careerists racing to defend their positions. And I think it's sad that the entire Democratic establishment seems more devoted to their careers than to beating Trump. The nominee best poised to beat our criminal president is clear. He has the most donors, he has the most volunteers, he fills the largest spaces, and he has a movement, entire generations behind them. And if we don't nominate Bernie Sanders, I fear that we are ducking into the punch of an extended Trump presidency. And it's clear to me that Joe Biden can't win the White House. It's clear to me that Bernie can. It's equally clear to me that the Democratic Party is confused as to its allegiances, which is why it's so important for we the people to raise our voice in the next few weeks. Driving turnout is critical. Making those calls to battleground states is critical. I do very much hope to see the youth turnout, on which our movement has been particularly focused. Youth far and away prefer Bernie Sanders. They're going to have to express it at the ballot box. And I hope that the voting processes in the states that have yet to vote accept those votes. You know, we've seen so many, frankly, suspicious results coming out of the early voting states. You know, in Iowa, the infamous debacle that happened there. In plenty of other states where Bernie is up, we've seen delegates that have yet to be awarded. And you know, now with the debate next week being adjusted, the format effectively to protect Biden, we see lots of, frankly, predictable Democratic Party chicanery, exactly what we saw in prior cycles. And it's all the more reason that we have to lean in to the next few weeks, secure the next battleground stakes, states, make Bernie the nominee, and then go on to win the White House.
I can't disagree with you there. Obviously, you know, best of luck to him in what remains of the race, and I agree it is far from over. And also in your own race as you go up against, you know, this titan in the Democratic Party of Nancy Pelosi. Best of luck to you, Chad Buttar, candidate for the 12th District of California. Thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a bit of tragic news after this. The story of Chelsea Manning, which for years has been a combination of tragedy and anger at the way that she has been treated by a system that she was trying to help, entered an even more tragic phase this week. Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst who was jailed last year for refusing to testify before a grand jury that is investigating WikiLeaks, has been hospitalized after she attempted suicide on Wednesday, according to lawyers. Ms. Manning is currently recovering. But a statement from from Ms. Manning's legal team said she's still scheduled to appear on Friday at a hearing before Judge Anthony Trenga of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. Now, this hearing, if you haven't been following the ongoing legal back and forth that has seen periods of like forcible containment and periods of freedom for very brief periods of time, at the hearing, the judge is expected to rule on whether to end the civil contempt sanctions imposed on Ms. Manning after she refused to testify before a grand jury investigating the publication of thousands of American military and diplomatic files that she had provided to WikiLeaks in 2010. And so there have been so many periods of this sort of thing, the ongoing legal battle. And now this, it's just, if you've been following this, it's absolutely tragic.
Yeah, it's easy to forget certain figures in our side if we talk about it so much when it's the beginnings of the story and then in the next step of prison time and all the charges, all that we stuck with. After that, we forget these folks exist and we forget that they're still dealing with the residual effect of it and the ongoing drama that that's around them. That's beside the point of a trans status that she was having to deal with, and people's impressions and judgments about her also included. So there's so many things stacked on top of her, and then something like this happens, and you wonder if it wakes people up enough to realize this isn't just a news cycle. This is someone's life.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I know that there have been a lot of people who have just been worn down by the never-ending injustice of this. Like the idea that this is something that at this point the US government, the legal system should be engaged in this ongoing war, has Chelsea Manning not suffered enough?
Right.
Like what will be gained by any of this?
Rob Blagojevich
just
was,
let her go.
Was
Blagojevich is out.
Come on.
Let her go.
Just saying.
Anyway, incredibly frustrating, and obviously our thoughts are with her. Thank you everybody for watching. Jer, as always, thank you for being here today. We've got a lot planned for the last show of the week, which Brett Ehrlich will be joining me for. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.